August 1st, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Brother Chip Hessenflam.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
We are here. We've made it to August. How about that? August 1st. And we are on Chapter 11, or as we also like to call it, Chapter 4 of Part 2 of The Valley of Fear. The title of this one, Pam?
The Valley of Fear.
Good. That's a good title.
And of course, I know you love the word scourers, so this is...
Do you notice how often I don't bother to try to say that word because it's too complicated for my face?
Well, you know, with my southern accent, I add a few more syllables to that.
Of course. It's a beautiful phrasing. This chapter is kind of straightforward, I think. It's not a long chapter. But it involves a lot of visitors. You could stage this chapter quite easily. So it opens, when McMurdo awoke next morning, he had good reason to remember his initiation into the lodge. His head ached with the effect of the drink, and his arm, where he had been branded, was hot and swollen. Having his own peculiar source of income, he was irregular in his attendance at his work. So he had a late breakfast and remained at home for the morning, writing a long letter to a friend. Afterwards, he read the Daily Herald. In a special column put in at the last moment, he read, "Outrage at the Herald office. Editor seriously injured." Hmm. And that is actually all caps because it's a headline. So,
should we mention our sponsors, Sprite and Advil?
And the Daily Herald, which is the name of our local newspaper.
So here we have, I find like this is an interesting paragraph because... we've got, obviously, a reminder of the day before, which is, of course, a month before for readers, that he was involved in beating up this editor, although he was also involved in stopping the beating from turning into a killing. He's just been branded. He's very, very hungover. And it's interesting that he spends the morning writing a long letter to a friend. Hmm. We haven't seen McMurdo talking about his friends from other places or writing long letters. So, I don't know. It strikes me as a bit mysterious.
Well, these are notes. You have to document what went on.
Captain's log. Wrote a note to a friend.
Exactly.
Let me make sure this is how I remember it. Mm-hmm. Who was there? What time was it?
Speaking of mysterious notes, however, McMurdo receives a mysterious note as well.
Indeed. And he read the note twice with the utmost surprise, for he could not imagine what it meant or who the author was. Had it been in a feminine hand, he might have imagined that it was the beginning of one of those adventures which had been familiar enough in his past life. Oh my, McMurdo. Dr. Watson, doesn't he?
Well, Watson's on three continents. Yeah. What about McMurdo?
Right?
He's on two.
At least. But
he was dating a Cubs fan back in Chicago. Remember when the Cubs won the World Series 4 years ago? Yeah, that was great.
But, to continue the quotation, it was the writing of a man, and of a well-educated one, too. Finally, after some hesitation, he determined to see the matter through. So the note asks him to meet this unsigned writer at a specific location. Off he goes. McMurdo is introduced to corruption.
Exactly. This is exactly where it happens.
Introduced? Really? That's the word that you chose to put into.
Listen, I've got a limited vocabulary, Steve. I only can write so many things. And all I can say is the corruption is confirmed. How about that?
There you go. There we go. We confirm some corruption in our secret society here, don't we?
That's right. And we have two people. We have McMurdo from the Chicago Lodge, and then we have Morris here from the Philadelphia Lodge. Steve, bring in a cheesesteak.
I was about to say cream cheese, but okay, cheesesteak is probably right.
So they had a big argument over Italian beefs and cheesesteaks.
Indeed, that is exactly the level of argumentation that we see when we arrive at this mysterious meeting. Now, Brother Morris, who's the well-educated man who sent the note, actually has, I think, a quite interesting conversation with McMurdo. And I think the dialogue in this chapter is excellent. Mm-hmm. I think the writing is super crisp and the dialogue is great. And Doyle is really getting at some very serious issues. So Brother Morris says, I would ask you then, when you joined the Freeman Society in Chicago and swore vows of charity and fidelity, did ever it cross your mind that you might find it would lead you to crime? If you call it crime, McMurdo answered. Call it crime, cried Morris, his voice vibrating with passion. You have seen little of it, if you can call it anything else. Was it crime last night when a man old enough to be your father was beaten till the blood dripped from his white hairs? Was that crime, or what else would you call it? There are some would say it was war, said McMurdo, a war of two classes with all in so that each struck as best it could. Mm. Whoa.
That's quite a justification.
What we're seeing here, guys, this is getting into some pretty serious cultural analysis.
Well, it just shows, you know, the challenges potentially of moving to a small town that is growing quickly because of a single industry. So, you know, what do we get from Brother Morris? We get a person who wants to better his life, who's moving because he thinks that he can work to the betterment of his family. And he immediately gets involved with something that he didn't sign up for. He just joined the fraternity in Philadelphia with some pretty simple ideals that he would like to have expressed, and all of a sudden now he's part of organized crime.
Right. The group in Philadelphia, he was there for fellowship. This was a group of people who came together to work together to, like you said, better their lives, not to create havoc like this group that we see here.
And I think it's interesting that for Brother Morris, this is clearly a situation where he has now become an accessory to murder. He feels totally trapped, and he feels like he's now part of an organized criminal situation. He's part of an organized crime syndicate.
Mm-hmm.
But what McMurdo says back to him is like, this is a war. This is a war between labor and capital. And we're the labor. We have to stick together. And so that's a completely different framing, right? And this is the conversation about unions that, let's face it, guys, we still have this conversation today, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
And this is really like setting up. I think this is British author setting up the American system of unions, of policing, and of corruption.
Mm-hmm. This is deep. This is another deep. This is not as dark a chapter as last chapter. We don't get the violence inherent in the system, but we do see the system and the reasons why certain people would become a part of these groups for fellowship, for economics, for all sorts of reasons.
Well, and I think it's interesting that at the end of this conversation, McMurdo says, listen, I'm not going to tell anybody that you have some serious concerns about this fellowship that we both belong to. Did that come as a surprise to you guys?
What, you're talking about the agreement they had at the end where he goes, hey, listen, people are going to ask why we had this conversation, and you're going to tell them I offered you a job, and then you turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
did that surprise you, that subterfuge here?
Well, it was very thoughtful because, as we learn later on, Morris's reservation of having this conversation and knowing that he will be watched and McMurdo will be watched, they need to create a situation that they can easily say, oh, this is what we talked about. Because you know what's going on. As Morris said, if they would find out what he's really talking about, his life is in danger and his family's life is in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And now, but were you guys surprised that Brother Morris actually approached McMurdo, this brand new guy who was just initiated last night and who was like, hey, I'm all in. I'm a counterfeiter. I'm all in to beat up this newspaper guy. It's kind of interesting, right? That Brother Morris chooses to confide in McMurdo.
Well, they're both outsiders. One's mm-hmm. from Philadelphia, one's from Chicago. Mm-hmm. At this point, being a new person, there's still the ability to influence how a person perceives the situation. And then, you know, obviously McMurdo, every time he turns around, he's having the suspicion confirmed. So, mm-hmm. I mean, any person reading this book at this point is recognized there's something going on. And my assumption is over the next chapter or two, we'll have it confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you think there's a certain level of desperation in Brother Morris's reaching out to this guy?
Doesn't McMurdo even respond to that? He says, like, listen, 10 cents on the dollar, get out of here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. He sees it from his perspective, and he says, this is not worth it. This is not, all of this fear that you have of this system is not working for you. You should leave this system regardless of the cost.
But I'm writing some notes that I'm sending to a friend. Maybe I'll just put this note in there for us.
Right. And now, as we were just saying, this is a chapter where a lot of visitors come by. So McMurdo goes out after his late breakfast and his letter writing and meets Brother Morris. He heads back home, and then who appears but Bodymaster McGinty?
Yeah. He's like, yeah, Bodymaster McGinty. He shows up there.
And he says, tell me about your conversation with Brother Morris. And McMurdo's like, wow, you got an eye on me. And McGinty says, look, don't hang out with him. I wouldn't get about too much with Morris, says McGinty. Why not? Well, I guess because I tell you not. That's enough for most folks in these parts. It may be enough for most folks, but it ain't enough for me, counselor, said McMurdo boldly. If you are a judge of men, you'll know that. The swarthy giant glared at him, and his hairy paw closed for an instant round the glass, as though he would hurl it at the head of his companion. Then he laughed in his loud, boisterous, insincere fashion. You're a queer card for sure, said he. Well, if you want reasons, I'll give them. And he goes on to enumerate, I love that dialogue, you guys. You get such a feeling of the two men, right? Including that loud, insincere laugh of a guy who's like, I'm the boss here, but I don't really know if I'm quite superior to this brand new, young, brash guy who I've just allowed to join my organization.
Hmm.
You listen here, you Chicago guy here. Yeah. I run these parts.
Yeah. The idea of menacing with this glass that it looked like he was about to throw it at the guy's head, that is first of all, good narrative description. I mean, I understood this scene so well because of those words. And secondly, boy, is that menacing. That is danger.
And so for all of our Spider-Man readers, just think of the Kingpin character with like a great big beard.
Mm-hmm.
And also, think about this as staged. You could totally stage this chapter. It's how it's framed, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Dialogue with great stage directions.
With people just coming and going because everybody's coming to McMurdo today. Today's McMurdo day.
Our next visitor, Steve, is a certain guy called Marvin.
Marvin!
You know, I don't know if that really works for this character.
I'm from Chicago!
Chicago on Mars, right?
there's other Chicagos.
It was Captain Marvin, once of Chicago and now of the Mine Constabulary. He shook his head with a half smile at McMurdo. I thought you'd be getting into trouble, Mr. Crooked McMurdo of Chicago, said he. Can't keep out of it, can you? Take your hat and come along with us. I guess you'll pay for this, Captain Marvin, said McGinty. Who are you, I'd like to know, to break into a house in this fashion and molest honest, law-abiding men? Captain Marvin here, he's being a little brash. He's kind of being a bit of an alpha dog. But he still gives him a chance to grab his hat because it's still the 19th century.
That's right, because it's still early 1900s, and that's what you do. You wear a hat when you leave a house.
Exactly. So they don't pull him out in handcuffs. They're like, get your hat. We're taking you down to the station.
How about McGinty? I guess you'll pay for this. Right, exactly. Captain Marvin, you're going to pay for this.
And then the narrative really is attempting, I think, to make the reader angry because we know, of course, that McMurdo totally participated in the beating of this guy. When he gets down to jail, Ted Baldwin is there. There are three other scourers, exactly the guys who did it. And McGinty's like, no worries, you were at my bar all night. Mm-hmm. And then listen to this quote. But even within this inner fortress of the law, the long arm of the freemen was able to extend. Late at night, there came a jailer with a straw bundle for their bedding, out of which he extracted two bottles of whiskey, some glasses, and a pack of cards. They spent a hilarious night without an anxious thought as to the ordeal of the morning. Old man, blood on his white hair. And this is the punishment they get. They get to spend a night in jail, carousing, drinking, playing cards, having a great time, knowing full well that they're not going to be punished.
Just like the movie Roadhouse, Steve. It's like
Swayze Christmas.
Well, no, very Swayze. No, I'm like
I know about that movie. I've never seen that movie. The only thing I know of it is a very Swayze Christmas from MST3K. Well, thank you.
One of the greatest lines in it is Patrick Swayze saying, "Pain don't hurt," which is something that is, you'll have to just look it up. It is very, very funny. But anyway, there is a boss who owns the town, and this is just like McGinty owns the town. I'm going to send the guys a bottle of whiskey, some cards. We'll get you out in the morning.
A hilarious night. I think Pam is right that this is meant to spark anger in the reader. The audience, know that these guys are guilty. They busted up this old man who is just doing his job, being the journalist, being the one who's reporting things, and they spent a hilarious night. That's quite a word.
Yes. Which brings us to the end of the chapter. Needless to say that they were discharged with something very near to an apology from the bench for the inconvenience to which they had been put, together with an implied censure of Captain Marvin and the police for their officious zeal. The verdict was greeted with loud applause by a court in which McMurdo saw many familiar faces. Brothers of the Lodge smiled and waved, but there were others who sat with compressed lips and brooding eyes as the men filed out of the dock. One of them, a little dark-bearded, resolute fellow, put the thoughts of himself and comrades into words as the ex-prisoners passed him. "You damn murderers," he said. "We'll fix you yet." Mm. End of chapter.
Selling magazines. 100%. 100% selling magazines. I'm intrigued by this mystery. I love this writing. I wish Doyle wrote more serialized novels after this, because he's got it down pat here.
He owns America here. I am interested in seeing if Captain Marvin and McMurdo eventually reveal their connection.
Dun dun dun!
So at this point, guys, we have three chapters left in the American portion of the book, and then an epilogue, where we're going to return to Sherlock and Watson. So I just kind of wanted to take a second after this short chapter, and which I think we all enjoyed quite a lot, and ask, like, how are you liking, especially when The Study in Scarlet was also a book organized around a British part, an American part, how are you liking this novel? And what do you think about the pacing, the sort of American portion? Do the two parts of the story work well together? Where are you guys at on this first reading of this, which is a novel that I actually have read many times?
This is one of my favorites. Awesome. I do think that the novels work real well for the character. The short stories become repetitious. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously there's a formula they're following. And not that there's not a formula here, but the deal is we get a little more background, and Doyle is playing. He's a very playful writer, and certainly he has a character here, but, you know, his passions are the word, and you can kind of see it, especially when you get to the American parts where he's making up his story.
And Pam, I think your focus on the opening and the ending has really done well for us here, because the writing style, the great introduction to each of these episodic chapters, and the great, not quite cliffhanger endings, but intriguing enough to make me want to read the next chapter, Doyle really has mastered that.
Yeah, I think we can learn a lot from carefully looking at how Doyle sets up both the short stories and the novels. And this, as the fourth novel, I do think this is the one that's the best constructed. That's my opinion.
So do you think that Stephen King is going to respond to our our request to join us to learn about endings.
Oh, boy.
I need to state for the record that I think one of the finest writers out there.
Until the final chapter. I hated the ending.
He even made fun of himself.
Yes, it. That whole series where he everybody was saying that I hated the ending to him was just hilarious. He said it. He did a cameo where he was sitting on camera saying to the author character in that show, I hated the ending. He knows. He knows what he did. So we are almost ready for our wrap-up of not only this novel, but for the entire canon coming up just in a couple of days here. So,
well, COVID's almost over, Steve.
So we have solved COVID, which is good, because it's time to go back to school. That's what I've heard. So we have some questions. We would love to hear from you. We've got some things to discuss here. First, what are your top three Sherlock stories out of the group of 60 that we've read through the entire canon? What are your top three? We've been discussing them in groups, and now it's time for that to come to fruition. And our second question, and this is going to be a little bit of fun, I think. Our second question is, what tropes are important to a Sherlock Holmes story? Which of those things that we've seen over and over again that have become a part of mystery writing since are the most critical for you? We would love to hear your answers to those, and I think we've got some fun planned for that discussion.
High-speed cameras really help out, I think.
Yes, the 1914 high-speed cameras where you put the cover over your head and everybody stands still and don't smile because you can't hold a smile that long. That's the high-speed cameras we're talking about. Polaroid would be proud.
I think we should all be on bicycles as well. I feel like the bicycle is a very fine trope of the Sherlock Holmes.
Why are we listing them already? This is hold on to your tropes, people.
Shouldn't Tony Stark be in there somewhere?
You've already got the kingpin. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Send us an email. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes and answer some of our questions. We would love to hear your answers. Make sure you go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for the list of all of these conversations throughout the canon. And join us tomorrow as we get to chapter 12, even closer to the end of this whole conversation. Boy, I anticipate chapter 12. And I have high expectations for this. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Brother Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore, welcoming you to the Valley of Fear. What I want to talk about, what I want to thank you for, what I want to thank you for. It means so very much without you. I would never see the light. And I'm Pam Bedore, welcoming you to the Valley of Fear.
In the chapter called The Valley of Fear, in the book called The Valley of Fear. Good.
We're so sorry to disturb you guys. We did not mean to arrest you and accuse you of beating up this guy.
Good. Good job.